Well, thank you once again for coming. Thank you for your patience and kindness in attending this seminar. I hope it will be helpful to you. I'm going to read from the scriptures. We heard it earlier in our conference. Set an example for the believers in speech, in conduct, in love, in faith, and in purity. Until I come, devote yourself to the public reading of Scripture, to preaching and to teaching. Do not neglect your gift, which was given you through prophecy when the body of elders lay their hands on you. Be diligent in these matters. Give yourself wholly to them so that everyone may see your progress. Watch your life and doctrine closely. Persevere in them, because if you do, you will save both yourselves and your hearers. That's why speed of the leader, speed of the team matters. It's not just an organizational saying, speed of the leader, speed of the team. It's that if you watch your life and doctrine closely, you'll save both yourself and your hearers. That the stakes of being a leader of a team in a church is not just that the organization can work, is that people get saved. And people, as it were, end up crossing the finishing line in heaven. So our calling is an important calling. It isn't just a worker for a machine, as it were. We're not just doing an organizational thing. We're doing something profoundly serious. And people look at you, and in one sense, they take their cue from you. In this little book, Leadership Axioms, this is what the author says. The two most powerful words Jesus ever used were "follow me." The Apostle Paul told believers to imitate him just as he imitated Christ. Follow me, imitate me. They talk to the power of leading by example. A series of questions lurks in the minds of followers, questions that can best be answered simply by observing their leader. When followers wonder how joyful they should be about their work, all they should be able to do is observe their leader's joy level. How joyful is he, they ask themselves. How joyful is she? Because that's how joyful I will be. When they wonder how determined they should be in their jobs, they should just look at you and say, that's how determined I'm going to be. When they wonder how much credit they should give to others when good ideas get implemented, when they wonder how gracious they should be to their peers, when they wonder how quick they should be to admit their mistakes, when they wonder how much faith they should have, all they should have to do is look to their leader, and those followers should have their answer. Leaders must never expect from others anything more than they're willing to deliver themselves. They shouldn't expect higher levels of commitment or creativity or persistence or patience than they themselves manifest on a regular basis. If you cannot say, follow me, to your followers and mean it, then you've got a problem, a big one. Speed of the leader, speed of the team. That's sobering words, aren't they? But what we're looking at this morning is not so much our volunteers as us leading them, whether it's the team of elders and deacons, or a team of workers in a creche, or whether it's the welcome group, or a team that work outside, as it were, of the regular meetings of the church. There are all kinds of ways in which we're helping people serve Jesus well. And they are looking at us, and they take their cue. I thought it was a brilliant quote the other night. Was it from a Pastor Stalker from the 19th century? When they hear you, they see all that they know about you. That's profoundly insightful. And if they hear you speak the truth, but what they've seen is a leader who lets people down, they won't hear the truth as they should hear it. It's profoundly helpful. So what we're looking at really matters. And we've just heard that exhortation there to set an example. John Maxwell, I came across this quote. I thought it was very helpful. Oopsie daisy. Where's that gone? John Maxwell says, people buy into a leader before they buy into a vision. They need to know that you're credible, that you're gracious, that you're going to help them, that you're there for them to be able to carry out the tasks that God wants them to do. Without them buying into you, no matter what a vision you share, they are just not going to get it. So being a leader of a team, however small that team is, and you can bring it right down to a single mum with two kids. It doesn't need to be sort of some grandiose boardroom. Just we're all leaders of somebody. Now, I know what makes a good team player and a good team leader. Oh, thank you. You got it back for me. Pat Lencioni. has written a book. Pat is an American author, Christian believer. He writes ostensibly for the world of business, but actually most of what he's writing about is about human beings working with each other. He's written this book, and he said, I've sold a lot of books, and he has. He sold millions and millions and millions of books, but this one, he said, went viral. The ideal team player. And he talked about three qualities. And you need to know this. See, this is about a leader gaining an emotional intelligence. How does a team work? What makes a team gel well? What are the individual components? And we're going to look at how the team works in a minute, but let's look at the individual components. He talks about three qualities. He talked about humble, hungry, smart. Now, humble is about not needing my ego to be stroked, not needing glory, not needing a position, not needing a stage, but just happy to serve, humble. Hungry, hardworking, get on with things, self-starting, being responsible, do more than I'm asked, help my colleagues out when they've got problems they can't solve, that kind of thing. And smart is not clever. Smart is emotionally intelligent. I understand myself and manage myself, and I understand others different from me, and I manage them. Now, here's the thing. He said, now, what if you're just hungry? I mean, you're not humble and you're not smart. He says, you're a bit of a bulldozer. You just get out of the way, I'll do it. Now, you must have seen church members do that around the coffee station. Get out of the way, I'll do it. You know? What if you're humble, but you're not very hungry? You're just like, oh. But the key one is this smart one. He said, even if you're smart, if you're humble and hungry, but you're not smart, you're an accidental mess maker. You leave people feeling diminished. You leave people, so you get things done, and it's not about your ego, but because you don't understand they're different from you, you go, what's wrong with you people? What's wrong with you? Come on, man up. That kind of mindset will leave people feeling, and they'll soon not want to be on a team like that. So he says, what you need is a combination of all three qualities. Now, by God's grace, we should be humble, shouldn't we? We should be putting it to death. And Paul shows, we looked yesterday, you know, bias to action. Paul shows, you know, Christian ministry is hard work. And it's hard work in the same direction with not a lot of shout about it for a very long time. But the smart one gets us unstuck. We don't often understand ourselves well. We should. Calvin said, these are the two great things, is the knowledge of God and knowledge of self. But often we don't understand ourselves well. We don't manage ourselves. And we certainly don't understand that others are different. Now, a team leader will recognize these three areas are really important. Otherwise, we're going to have bulldozers, doormats, and charmers all over the place, and the team won't work very well. That was a very helpful insight. Now, what about the team itself? Well, yesterday we looked at this, didn't we? TLV. And we looked at the important bridging role that leadership provides. So teaching, embodied by the leader, enables volunteers to get active. And if you think of Jethro's little model of, you know, large all the way down to a group of 10, the leader of a group of 10 is responsible for getting that group of 10 active. So in a very simple sense, fathers, don't exasperate your children, but bringing them up instead in the teaching and admonition of the Lord. There's a little unit, mum, dad, and several kids, is a little unit where you're leading them forward. Now, what the leader, the key quality of a leader, and I love this, Derek Prime, some of you was pastor at Charlotte Chapel for very many years. So I was converted through reading one of Derek Prime's books many years ago. Derek wrote a book on New Testament leadership, brilliant little book on it. And he said the key quality, the one word that sums up what New Testament leadership is all about is the word encouragement. Encouragement. Barnabas, son of encouragement. Leaders have to breathe fresh heart into people all the time. The number one qualification of New Testament church is not efficiency, not even make it happen. It is learning to encourage. Most people feel pretty useless. Most people feel failures. Most people feel they've not got a lot to contribute. Most people feel, well, I do know the Lord, I love the Lord, but what use am I really to him? That's how many people feel. And leaders come alongside and breathe words of encouragement. Every now and then there is a word of rebuke. There is a challenge word. Of course, Paul challenges Christians. But most of the time he writes, he's writing words of encouragement. Remember that great bit at the end of Acts 20 when he gets all the Ephesian elders together? You know, as you hear that, you know, from some of your own number, and you think, oh, you know. And at the end, when he says, I'm never going to see you again, and most of you go, oh, great, good riddance. But they don't, do they? They all bawl their eyes out. Even though he's been incredibly direct with them, because he's spent a lifetime of loving them, encouraging them. And these last words of challenge and encouragement are words, and the guys, they cry at the thought they're never going to see Paul with their own eyes again. That's some testimony to a lifetime of encouragement. That if you're a leader, just think, am I encouraging? Am I encouraging? That's how I take the teaching and breathe energy into volunteers. Now, we talked a little bit about that yesterday. You know, remember that funny book title, Whale Done? You know, that sense of catching somebody and encouraging them. But what about how a team actually works? So one of the most useful tools I've come across to just get some understanding in a room of who's in the room is this one. It's called Five Voices. The authors are Jeremy Kubicek and Steve Cockrum. They're basically piggybacking on the five love languages. You come across that? You know, if you give you, my wife's a farmer's daughter. If I give her a bunch of flowers, that cut flowers, you know, well, it doesn't grow. I said, but I love you. Well, it doesn't feel like you love me. You just bought me something that's going to die in the next 2 days. That's not her love language, you see. You understand that. Well, what they're using that same... Now, okay, just as there are different love languages that make sense to somebody or not, so we speak with different languages, different voices, and they're dominant or not so dominant. Some of them are consciously competent. Some of them are unconsciously incompetent. Now, let me just run through the five and explain. They say, so there's a creative type. Oh, let me go think about this. I'll get the right shade of purple. It'll look fantastic. There's the connector. I know somebody you've got to meet at this conference. We'll use that app and we'll have coffee together. There's the guardian. Whoa, hold on a minute, Ray. Do you think we ought to look at how much this is actually going to cost before we say yes? Guardian voice, okay? And then there's two other voices. There's the pioneer. Onwards and upwards, come on. And then there's the nurturer. I don't really care how much you know till I know how much you care. These are sort of voices. Now, we speak with all those voices. We use them in different ways. But some of them will be consciously stronger than others. Some of them we don't. Oh, I didn't know. And in a team, what's great is if you have all the voices, as it were, in the room. People who are consciously competent nurturers, who care for people well, and it's their gut instinct. And others who love a vision and get on with it. And others who say, look, before we implement this plan, what about the unintended, unknown unknowns? Guardian voices. Creatives who are going to go away and come up with a great strap line. And you don't think that matters too much because you're not creatives. But if you're a creative, you go, oh, let me think about this. Who would have thought 25 years ago that orange would not be a fruit, it wouldn't be a colour, it would just be a phone. And the design of it was just a plain orange block with a little black thing in the corner. And you think, well, that's ridiculous. But it sold the company billions. Creative brilliance. If you're not a creative, you go, well, that's rubbish. If you're creative, you go, that's clever. And you need creators in the room. You need connectors in the room because sometimes you go, we need some help here. Who are we going to connect to that might help us? And we need to get thinking, how loud are those voices? So typically, guardians, I don't agree. That's quite a loud voice. Or the pioneer, come on! That's quite a loud voice. But what about old Mrs. Smith? What about old Mrs. Smith? That's quite a quiet voice. And if pioneers and guardians are speaking loud, some of the nurturers in the room keep their heads down, their mouths shut, and after the meeting, they worry their head off about old Mrs. Smith. How is she going to feel about this change that you pioneers have just announced? And quite simply put it like this, If you go to an average church members meeting, 60% of the room are nurturers by gut instinct. That's their dominant voice. If you put a pioneer on first, this is what we're going to do for Jesus. 60% of the room go, we are not going to do that for Jesus. Thank you very much. Because they go, where do people fit in all of this scheme of yours? What about the people? That's the nurturer's first instinct, you see. If you put a pioneer first, the pioneer will frighten everybody silly. So you put a nurturer on first and you say, do you know what? There are loads of old Mrs. Smiths in our community. And we just want to love them and care for them, because wouldn't we want them in the kingdom of God? Don't you know a Mrs. Smith down your road? I know one. And she is just lovely, but she needs Jesus. And then you get the pioneer on saying, this is how we're going to reach all those Mrs. Smiths, you see. But if you put the guy who's the pioneer on first, the nurturers will go, this isn't about people. This is about your scheme. We don't want your scheme. However clever it is, you just, no, thank you. See what I'm saying? So it makes a difference. It's not just a silly game. It's actually important. So in a room, you really want to, if you're leading a team, you need to know what voices have you got in the room, not just what are their strengths. You need to be able to say, like, thanks, Jim. It's great that you've given us some vision. But before, just hold on for a minute. Sue and Bill, tell us a bit more about how you think people might feel about this. You get that you have to empower nurturer voices. They won't naturally speak up. They'll be afraid of being shouted down. And, oh, you're always telling us about Mrs. Smith. Oh, I'm fed up with Mrs. Smith. That's how they feel. So you need to empower those voices. So if you're leading a team and you don't know who you've got in the room. Now, look, it's only a scheme. It's only ideas. It's not definitive. This is not the last word on this. But it helps create a little bit of self-understanding. It helps create a little bit of group understanding. It helps the group get smart. Not only positively, but negatively. An unconsciously incompetent guardian voice. So somebody who's a strong creative, but who is an unconsciously incompetent guardian will always be tutting with his... sit in the corner, you just folded hands. What does that say? I'm not happy. I'm not happy. You don't have to say anything, do you? But you don't even, do you know you sit there with folded hands looking frowning? Do I? I didn't know that. Unconscious, you see. You're a guardian and you don't even know it. You're not a good guardian, because a good guardian is thoughtful and makes, but you're kind of unconsciously incompetent guardian. So it's really hard. You think, Ray, that's my members meeting every time I get in front of them. But you see what I'm saying? So it just helps people think. Now, when we did this as a staff team, one of our ladies, she said, how did they know that was me? She said, I'm a connector. Now I know I'm a connector. That is me. And we said, yes, that is you, Louise. You are. Of course you are. You're just brilliant at bringing people into contact with one. We need you on our team. You can buy a book. Or you can go online and do this as a sort of little... And it generates discussion. It generates understanding how the team works, how the team sounds when it speaks. And as a leader of a team, this is really helpful to know. I've got a team of 8 people in the room. Are 5 of them strong guardians? Most accountants are guardians. Yeah, they are. It's what they're trained to do. They just like, too much money. You know, if you've got 5 of them in the room, you will shape what you say to get these guardians on board. And by, do you know what I'm saying? Now, typically, 60% of people are nurturers. About 10 to 15% of people are guardians, connectors, and then smaller numbers are creatives and pioneers. But the pioneers are loud. But there's small numbers on. So I use this illustration many times. I once said to a lady called Tina, we were a church about 200 at the time, 250 maybe, saying, Tina, would you want to be in a church of 1,000 people? Now, for pioneer, that is, oh, wow, love it. Come on, bing on the numbers. The more noughts, the better. That's pioneer language, okay? They love it, numbers. She said, Ray, that would be absolutely awful. I'd hate that. I don't want to be in a church like that. She's a nurturer. So I said, oh, Teen, what if your husband Clive and your daughter Laura and your son Darren became Christians? I said, Oh, I'd love that. Well, that's what it is, Tina. If every one of us had three people we love on earth saved, we'd be a church of 1,000 people. I'd love it. See? It's a different language. And it resonated. One language, if I was in a group of pioneers, we wouldn't worry about, we'd just, come on, let's talk about, and how are we going to manage those numbers? And you can see them doing the number crunch and go, God, there's 10 groups of this and 5 groups of that. And like, okay, we're training this. But most people are not pioneers. So it's no good talking loads and loads of pioneer language if the room isn't full of loads and loads of pioneers. And most teams will have a mixture of voices. So it just is wisdom, isn't it, to say, how do these people speak? And what are they weak at? What are they strong at? How can we get all the voices in the room? I found it very helpful. We've used it with various teams. And most people, it's like aha, light bulb moment. Of course you're that. Of course, I knew that. And now this has helped me understand why. It's the team technique. Another book that Pat Lencioni has written is called this one, The Advantage. Why organizational health trumps everything else in business. Now, that's really fascinating, isn't it? You see, he's writing ostensibly a business book, but it's nothing to do with money at all. It's all to do with human beings and how human beings can keep, like, healthy, not work culture in terms of personal relationship, but how does the team work healthily? And he came up with this. You build a cohesive leadership team. Go, hold on a minute. That's an eldership, isn't it? Yes, you're right. Or it could be the team that runs all the kids' work in your church, a cohesive team. And notice what he says. Point two, create clarity. Point three, over-communicate clarity. Point four, reinforce clarity. So it's all about clarity. It's not so much about how do we get on with one another, you know, when we're having coffee together, are we friends? That's important. But it's mainly saying, are we clear about who does what around here? Whose responsibility? Who's going to take that on? How are we going to create accountability? If everybody does everything, nothing gets done. So you know that, is it anybody, everybody, nobody and somebody little quip? Where everybody thought that somebody could do it and, you know, nobody ended up doing it because everyone thought someone was doing it. You know, that kind of, that's what happens in teams, isn't it? Well, we all do this, which means nobody does it. So they were going to hand over, great clarity in Acts 6, we are going to hand over this responsibility to them. We're going to hand over this responsibility, feeding the widows, we are going to hand that responsibility over to them. And great clarity, you choose. We all know who they are. They're publicly set apart. Everybody knows who's responsible for feeding the widows around here. Seven names, here they are. If you've got any problem with feeding widows, they're the guys you go to because it's, we are all now crystal clear how this is going to be done in our church. It creates clarity. Now, one way of doing that is within the team, say, okay, what are the jobs that need to get done? A moment of clarity came to us. We've got a vision team, you know, people who sort all the sound and that out. It's very helpful. But the feeling was you had to be an ultimate techie to be on the vision team. You know, you really, really need to be, you know, kind of complete sort of anoraki techie type. And the guy said, no, you don't. You know, as they wrote the job description, we need two or three guys who set up and fix problems like the guy did for me here just a few moments ago. But actually, most of the time, we just need button pressers who are good button pressers. They've got to be, you know how some button pressers, 1,000 people turn around to the guy doing it, like, we're on the next verse, you know? Does that happen at your church? Every single week. Yeah, we're on. So it's all like somehow they get mesmerized, don't they? Oh, look at But you can train some button pressers, but you only need to be a button presser. You don't have to fix all the techie side. And so they wrote some job descriptions, said, actually, we have thought in our head that we need really, really switched on techie people. But we don't. We need two of those, but we need about four people who would just be willing to sing the songs. And as they come to the end of the verse, they just press the buttons, they sing the next verse. They're basically worshipping, but unlike the rest of them, they just press the button. We need someone. We could train and just getting some clarity in what is actually needed. I told you yesterday about somebody needs to do the orange squash halfway through the kids' talk. We could do with an orange squash mixer. She could hate children, but hey, she can do more orange squash. That's great. So we just wrote job descriptions. Now, it sounds a bit OTT, doesn't it? Job descriptions for an orange squash maker. But you don't have to do it as technical as that. But getting some clarity about what needs to be done, who's going to do it. And particularly at senior leadership level, as a church gets bigger, you've got to move from generalists to specialists. You may be a generalist, but now your special responsibility is. So I told you earlier about growing large by growing small. You need to put resources into small group. So one of our staff workers spends half his working week simply on small groups. He visits small group leaders, one-on-ones. He visits small groups. He produces material. He gauges how small groups are going. He plans his whole brain is like, your job within our team eldership, you're spending half your working week. That's your responsibility. Nobody else is doing it. If you don't do it, it doesn't get done. That's your responsibility. We need to be as crystal clear, because what happens in an organization when you've all done a little bit of everything, you still want to keep on doing all one a little bit of everything. And even when you say, look, I know I'm responsible for small groups, but I really just want to look what's in his in tray. And before you know it, everybody is really putting their nose in everybody else's responsibility, and it's all going a bit pear-shaped. We need sort of clarity. Clarity. What is the senior pastor's role? Who? How many people is he looking after? Have you gone from a multi-staff? So initially, Larry Osborne in his book, Sticky Church, I mentioned it, he talked about track athlete. Many of us single pastors like a track athlete, where we're doing our running and the church kind of cheering us on. But then you grow a team, maybe a couple of elders, maybe some staff workers, and you're like a little, you're like golf buddies. I went through a phase for about 7 or 8 years when we were golf buddies. We're three elders. It was me, a doctor, and an architect. And we met in the lunch hour near Milton Keynes over coffee. We just talk about church. You happy with that? Yeah, I'm happy with that. Have you seen John yet? Oh, yeah, I had a good chat with John last week. Do you think we ought to change the church's name? Yeah, it might be a good idea, Ray. Okay, let's think about it. Golf buddies. Everything was done like nod and a wink, tacit, mates together. But then you grow into, Osborne talks about, a basketball team. So you're now sort of maybe a dozen of you, and you know, you've got defense and offense and people on and off the pitch, and who makes those calls? You change the way you run. You need to become more specialist. Now, Colin, if you're going to stay later today, he's going to talk about a mega church. Colin leads a huge church on a multi-site, thousands of people. Well, the way they organize is different yet again. It's not that one's right and another's wrong. It's at different stages you need some wisdom. One of the big changes we found, we went from a multi-staff, was about four of us, where we were all together. Didn't, you know, it was all kind of like done well. But then we began to realize that actually we were multi-layer staff. So we're about 10 staff now, some part-time, some full-time. And even the part-timers, you know, you got from 3 days down to 1 day. You know, who is going to manage these? Well, I'm doing it. You cannot manage 8 or 10 staff. You can't do it. You just have enough. You'll get nothing else done, because if your job is to enable those staff to succeed, that's pretty much every one of them takes 2 or 3 hours of your working week. 10 staff, that's 30 hours of your working week gone. What else? Like, oh, nobody told me that. Everybody told me that if I got more staff, they'd be able to do things I'm not doing. No, you get more staff. You need to look after those staff. And actually, you've got a guy here looking after like what we call operations, making things happen. And the admin two workers in the admin team basically work for him. He's their line manager, and you're his line manager. And use that parlance, or you're his support worker, and he's their support worker. And that happens like, oh, I didn't know that was happening. Now, when you get there, it's obvious. But when you're growing to get there, it's not so obvious at all. You have to think some of this stuff through. So you need clarity. Clarity. What about running a great team meeting? Well, I found this the most helpful thing I've ever come across. I think this, when I came across this, I thought this is gold dust. You get this now. Wow, I wish I knew this. I didn't discover this till I was probably nearly 50. And it's just like, because I don't know about you, running small teams, running meetings, I run lots of little small meetings, it's quite demanding. How can we ensure that our meetings get better? because so much happens in small meetings, and churches have thousands of meetings and not a lot to show for it after all that talking, really. So how can we make them better? Came across this. It's called the Care Plan. Some of you may have heard me talk about it. I'm glad you're here because I need to remind myself of this very regularly. So even if you know this, it's good to get it again. When a group gets together, you start by clarifying the mission. Let's talk what we're about. Let's not talk what we're going to do. Let's talk about the big picture. Came across this quote. I like this one. People aren't a team because they work together. They are a team because they have a common purpose that is understood by everyone and that they all appreciate and value the different part each person plays in achieving it. You see, it isn't that they work together. It's they work together on a common vision, a common mission. So you need to talk about the mission. And typically that means telling stories about people whose lives have been touched. We looked at that picture, yes, if you were here. That's terrific, isn't it? Top leader, fist punting, somebody who's on the same team. I'm on a team that makes America great, says the janitor. That's the same team as the president. We're on the same team. And it's lovely when someone at the top of that team acknowledges that somebody else is in the team. That's creating a sense of purpose. So typically at home when we do this, we talk lots and lots about people. Whose lives has our team touched? Let's pray for those people now. It may be sad stories. It may be happy stories. It may be stories of joy. It may be stories of sorrow. But as you talk about people who've been touched, new kids starting coming to the club, and somebody says, let me tell you about this little boy and his sister. Let me tell you about the background they've come from. And you realize, wow, God is at work in this little boy. Who knows? He might be. He might be the next Spurgeon. Who knows? He might be. He might be the next road cleaner of our street. He's still got great dignity. And he might be one day in heaven. And one day he'll say, thank you for loving me when I was a little boy. Let's tell stories like that. And as your team tells stories like that, you see, what happens if you don't tell those stories, if you don't keep on mission, the job gets boring, dull, and routine. You get ways of doing the job quickly. And it's like, get it out of the way. One of my children's workers, I asked him once, how's it going? He said, oh, it's going great, Ray. We're home by 7:15 on Fridays now. I said, oh, what? What do you mean? He said, well, we've only got 15 kids. So we can get home early. Isn't that great? And I go, that's not great. Last time I knew your kids' club had 35 kids. Yeah, I know, it's great. We've only got 15 now. And it was like, okay, I think we forgot the purpose. The purpose is not how to get home early on a Friday night. But you see, that's what happens. If you don't talk stories, like how do I get this job done? Because the job becomes repetitive. It becomes dull. You know this, British Health and Safety. There's a machine over here. And it's got a cover on it because you've got to close the cover because your hand could get mashed inside the machine. And then you close the cover and you walk across here and press a button so you can never get injured. So what do? You get a big stick. And you stand over here and you put it in and you press the button with a stick. And one day, the hand goes in because it's become so boring, dull and routine. It's how we get round. Everybody gets round rules all the time. All those rules that are meant to be to keep us become rules to life. And that's how church work can become. If you don't motivate people. And motivation is not, come on! That's not motivation, is it? That's telling off. Motivation isn't, look, can you see how God is at work? And even if you don't think God is at work, he's like, well, let's keep praying because God is at work. God is at work. My father's in the Royal Air Force. We moved around a lot. We're lovely, lovely home, but not a religious home. But on one Air Force station, RAF Halton, 1966, there was a little Sunday school. And to get me and my sister out of the way, we said, well, why don't you go to Sunday school? What's a Sunday school? Well, go along anyway. Anyway, all I remember of the few weeks I went is I am H-A-P-P-Y. That's it. Don't remember anything else. I don't even know what the rest of the song is. I just know H-A-P-P-Y. I thought, oh, lay picture. But I remember as a six-year-old boy, those people were very kind. They were very kind. And many, many years later in my life, when I came across Christians, I remember they were Christians. And they were very kind. So when Christians started talking to me, God had used that tiny little bit of exposure to say, one day, Ray Evans, when I call you into my kingdom, you will realize that the links in the chain go all the way back to when you were a little six-year-old singing H-A-P-P-Y. Those Sunday school leaders haven't got a clue. See? And that's going to happen to you one day. You're in heaven! I can't believe it! Well, God used you to sort of work in my life, and you don't even know it. You tell those stories, because that's what keeps people motivated. But then you agree on goals. You agree on goals. So you then say, okay, what are we going to do? How are we going to do it? How are we going to do it? What specifically are we going to do to make this team work better? And who's going to do how we what are going to do? And when are you going to do it by? How much is it going to cost? You talk smart language, specific. Who is going to do it? Who is going to get the coffee? Our girls back at home are doing a charity Advent concert. There's a small team, about eight of them, putting on this charity concert. They've got a harpist up from London called Sunshine Lowe. What a lovely name, that, Sunshine Lowe. She's going to play, and there's a flautist called Lois is going to play. They play some sort of Christmas music, and Lois is going to talk about each of the songs they're going to play. And the team have got together, and somebody said, I'll do the canapes. Somebody else, I'll sell the tickets. Somebody else, I'll do the publicity. Specific jobs. How is this ever going to work? All right, let's break it down into all the component parts. I'll do that bit. You do that bit. When are you going to do it by? Oh, the publicity has to be out by the beginning of November. Right, who's going to take the money? What if somebody gives us a check with the wrong name on it? I'll sort it. Leave it with me. That kind of, the team together talks about how it's going to be done. What you don't do as a leader is walk into the room and say, I'm boss. You do that, you do that, and you do that. You're my workers. I'm your boss. That is going to kill a team. They might do it, but by next month they go, I'm going to go and serve on another team. Because actually, I don't mind being a minion. I don't mind being a slave, because Jesus has called me to be that. But do you know what? That idea that you just delegate and just dump the naff jobs on us. Well, I've got more important things to do in my time than do naff jobs. And if I have no say as a team, what are we about? That thing about dumping on people is, you know the phrase called seagull management. You swoop down, you squawk all over, you dump, and you fly off again. It doesn't go down well. I mean, go to St. Ives and try and eat a piece of fish and you'll find what seagull management is all about. They do that. And it's not fun, is it? But agree on goals. Make them specific, measurable. A could be assignable. Who's going to do it? And it's got to be relevant. Is it our team's job? And timed. Timed is really important. One of the things that slips in church life is, when is it going to be done by? What's the time parameters? And we've got to stick to that. So agree on goals. R is review progress. You build into a team, how are we doing? How could we do it better? What's working well? What's not working so well? Now, if you don't build in review as normal, when somebody gets a bit of feedback, they will take it like a dagger to the heart. Like, you know, as a preacher, don't you? If somebody comes up to you and says, yeah, Ray, that's really helpful, but, and you, oh, no, not right now. Oh, please. But if it's normal, you go, oh, please tell me, I'd really want. If you build in feedback as normal, everybody gets reviewed. So it's not a personal attack on you. We as a team review. We might ask for outside. How do you think we're doing? I just heard somebody go up to one of the church leaders here and said, oh, the band is brilliant. And the guy said, look, there's a form, feedback form. Put it down. Tell us. We love to hear back. You see this? Feedback review is the best indicator known to the medical profession for improved performance. If you don't get feedback on what you do, you don't get better. And better to have peer review than is some outside consultant. You know, if you have an Ofsted inspector, everybody sharpens up the act for a week. Then it goes back to normal. It's the same with church. If I know that you know, John Stevens is sitting on the back row. I was like, oh, boy, I better do my best today, kind of thing, you know. As soon as, oh, great, John's gone now, I can do my normal. Why aren't we all like that, a little bit like that? Well, you know all that. When you can be in the middle of a family conversation, come round, the doorbell goes, oh, we better all smarten up, all right. Let's pretend to be happy families. Well, that doesn't help, does it? So you say, how can we create a better... And if people chip in, I thought that went really well. Oh, I thought that... I don't think that worked very well. That kind of thing. Review. And everybody takes part. And then finally, E, equip the team. Equip. How can we equip? Could we... We need some new members on the team. Let's go and recruit somebody. Oh, I know somebody that'd be great. The best people to recruit people into teams are existing team members, not church leaders who are remote. People take it a lot better from someone they know and go, this is a kind of one of those genius things. If you want people in home groups, don't you tell them where to go. Get the home group leader, say, come and join my home group. You'll love it. I love you in my home group. I love you in my team. Let the team do it. We're a little bit over-controlling. Learn from the Royal Air Force in World War II. How did they team a bomber squadron? Well, they got a big room. You got 14 planes, so you need 14 pilots, 14 flight engineers, 14 rear tail gunners, 14 navigators, so on and so forth. They put all the men in the room, hundreds of them, in a big hangar, and said, "Find your crew." So people start going around like, "What are you? I'm a bomb aimer. Oh, right. You stay here. Let's us two now go and find a pilot." And that's how they crewed. They crewed squadrons by guys in rooms talking to one until they found enough guys to say, we're now a bomber. They didn't over-dictate. They just said, you know what, just leave it to people to sort it out. Trust that ordinary people have got brains, you know. They can go and find other people for the team. Don't over-control. You don't need to. And they'll work it out. They'll know, like, oh, Fred, you know, I don't think you'll fit in our team. But Sue, oh, she'll be great. Oh, I've had a chat with Sue. With a bit of encouragement, I think Sue could join our team. Isn't that amazing? You don't have to do any of that. It's like it's done for you. Whereas we tend to think, oh, I've just got to find out how I can place you. And why do we need? We don't need to. That's, we need to like, hold on a minute. Let's trust people here. The team might need some training. Let's watch a video and discuss. Let's read a paper. Let's go. Let's do a book. Let's go on a training course. Our bereavement team at home, we have a team that helps support those who've lost loved ones. They've all done the cruise counselling training. So they've helped sort of gain a degree of expertise. It may be that the team just needs to go and have a curry and chill and just have some downtime. But here's the thing. If you don't have a meeting where you step back from what you deliver, you only operate as a team when you deliver. You never stand back and think about what you do. You won't get any better. In fact, what happens over time, you wear people down. It will feel like a rota. So you have to create space in church life to say, we want our teams to stand back and go through a care plan. Now, what we do, we tend to have home groups, 3 weeks out of four. The fourth week tends to be a meeting altogether, like a members meeting or a visiting missionary speaker or something like that. But there are four five-week Thursdays. We work on a Thursday thing. There are four a year. One of them is always at the end of the year. It's useless between Christmas and New Year, so forget them. But there are three. And in that week, we have no planned meetings. So we say to any of the teams, look, there are no other meetings on that week. If you want your team to get together, you know that the fifth week of a month is the week when you can have a team meeting. And you're not asking people to go to several meetings that week because there's not lots of meetings on. It's just a small little thing, but it's helped our teams stand back and think. Now, here's the thing. The role of the leader in all this is crucial. When you work through the care plan, the role of the leader is to get other voices speaking. See, one of the big problems of church life as it gets bigger is in a group of 30, everybody can have a little bit of a say. In a group of 60, not so many. In a group of 800, impossible. So how do you have much of a say? Well, you have a lot of say about the team where you serve. And church leaders particularly want to always be a little bit controlling. We want it done exactly this way. Well, if you want it done exactly this way, you will end up doing it because you're the only one who can do it exactly that way. You've got to say, look, here's the big picture. Here's the parameters. We are going to hand this responsibility over to you, and you figure how to feed the widows. We're going to trust you. You come up with your scheme. We're not going to over-control that. We may have done it differently, but hey, you're doing it for us, and we trust you. We're not going to tell you, sorry, you've got to start in the southern suburbs first and work your way up the valley. You work it out. And a team leader, the role of the team leader is almost a convener. And just keep working through. Okay, we've spent some time on clarifying the mission. Let's now move on to goals. And let's now move on to review. Now let's move on to equip. Now, if you follow that simple little plan as a leader, your meetings will be great. People will feel they've had a say. They've talked about a variety of different kinds of things that shape the team. They certainly will feel the team is going to deliver better every time they then deliver. They feel they've had an input. And sometimes the ideas are crazy. But the great thing about a team discussing is they self-filter. Okay? When we were discussing once about building, a lady said, oh, well, one way of solving the problem, Ray, is why don't we have a tent? And I was like, okay. And somebody said, oh, Doreen, we can't have a tent every week. It's a good idea, but it can't work every week. Now, I could have easily jumped in and go, Doreen, we cannot put a tent up every week. Come on. But I didn't have to because someone in the team very gently said, Doreen, that's a great idea, but it wouldn't work every week, would it? And I'm like, that's team dynamics at work. The team self-correct. Somebody says, look, somebody might say, look, we need a 3,000-pound subwoofer. I think it'd be brilliant, right? But the team go, do you know what? Probably a bit too expensive. And I was like, you are joking, aren't you? You're too expensive. But you don't need to jump in. Most things, the team will self-sort out. Crazy ideas will get filtered out. Somebody say, that's a great idea, but I don't think we can do that one. It's beyond our remit. Oh, yeah, I suppose it's right. Don't be worried about the crazy in the team. Let the team will sort the crazy out. And as a leader, you just trust the team to sort this one out. And I have been amazed how... See, the great thing about the care plan, look, it's made for ordinary leaders like you and me. Brilliant leaders don't need a care plan. But we're not brilliant leaders. We're just ordinary leaders. And this enables us to have a degree of structure running a really good meeting. Everybody has a say. The leader is kind of summarizes at the end, right? So the leader... The power you have as a leader is the power of summary. It's the power of a chair. A chair normally does not wade in with a very strong opinion. The chair lets everybody speak. And this is now, look, let me summarize. And we summarize, I think, in my opinion, given what we've said, I think this is the best way forward. Are you all happy with that? Chair, the power of the chair. That's the power of the leader. And we've tried to sort of inculcate the care planners. Every team needs to work with a care plan. You do this three times a year. It kind of like, teams are working. People are enjoying serving in the team because they have a say and they're shaping it and they're owning it. See, if you say, you own. It is amazing, isn't it? In Acts 6, I would have been tempted to say, well, I wouldn't have got it right in the first place. I would have been preaching sermons from Exodus and Numbers. I would have been telling everybody off that they were sinning against God. I would have misread Acts 6. But even if I got it right, I'd have said, right, I found the people, and these are the great guys I know, and are you okay with that? Because I've made the decision. What is it? The apostles brilliantly said, you choose. You choose. And because everybody chose, everybody owned the decision. It's one of the hardest things in church life is to get everybody owning the decision. How do you do that? Well, the apostles cracked it. And I'm like, oh, my goodness, that's brilliant. I wish I got some of that wisdom. Well, the care plan helps get a bit of that wisdom. Okay, final thing. There's a guy called Les McEwen. It's written a whole load of books, business books. But, you know, they're not really about business at all. They're really about organizations, of which businesses are one. But this could be a charity. It could be a brownie pack. It could be the army. It could be any. Sometimes we read business, we all think, oh, it's worldly, it's business. Now, most of this is about human beings working together in groups. That's what an organization is, isn't it? So it's organizational wisdom. Now, you have to filter some of it out. So you read Do Scale, a roadmap to growing a remarkable company. One of his books, you know, I did that diagram earlier, and I told you about the beginning was scary, then it was fun and white water, and it was treadmill, big rut and death. The top thing he calls predictable success. And I thought, if I announce predictable success at an FIEC conference, I will get skinned alive. So, but you see, that's where you go, look, filter that out. We don't believe in predictable success because God is sovereign. But the rest of that diagram is remarkably healthy and helpful because that is how it is. That's how organizations are. They start small, they have a lot of fun, then they grow, and it gets outside of their ability to cope, and they need some processes and some structures and some organization. But if you over-process and over-structure and over-organize, you get into a rut, and eventually a rut will kill you. So you just filter out the bit that's not very helpful. And you say, well, it's all tainted by that. No, it's not. It's not tainted by that. It's just, that's how it is. It's a very helpful insight into how living things grow, and then they mature, and eventually they wither and die. Now, that might be an oak tree over 500 years. It might be next spring's flowers that are going to bloom soon. But that's how things are. So there's a lot of wisdom then. And this latest one he's written recently, it's only a short paperback. It's only about 50 pages. You read it in an hour. He talks about the difference between startup and healthy. So in startup, it's all guns blazing, it's all energy, it's all fast decisions, it's all, come on, come on. And in a small church, we were a very small church, we started as 12 people, we know all about getting that going. You just need tons of committed, united energy. So we used to have a games afternoon, we got to about 60 people, everybody would come, the grannies, the babies, everybody, games afternoon. A church our size now, we have games afternoon, only the people that really are fanatical about games will turn up. Because it's like, well, it's not my kind of thing. But some remember, oh, come on, we're a church, we should be. But that's startup. As you get to maturity, you go, fine, you don't like games, fine. That's all right, it doesn't matter. But that mindset changes, so he looks at that change. And the one thing he says that you need to grow as you get bigger. Oh, hold on, I'll get back. He talks about this high-quality team-based decision-making. I thought, I like that. Okay, it's a bit jargony, I know. But actually, so much in church life is based around teams of people making decisions that are good decisions. So you know one of the great complications in church life is not, is it right or is it wrong? If you were here yesterday, you would have heard me. Is it wise or unwise? It's a different category. It's a different mindset, isn't it? It's not, so many Christians only think black, white, right, wrong. It's wrong, Pastor, that we've colored the walls that shade of purple. You know, we've got the wrong kind of carpet on the floor. What, you mean it's a sin? No, I don't mean it's a sin, but it's just wrong. But it's not wrong, because it's not moral. It's not right, wrong. It's not very clever. In a church, if you've got the kind of carpet, you might have that, like, you know, that nice generic kind of light cream carpet most people have. That isn't clever in church, is it? Because the first Sunday is destroyed with all these footprints. And we don't do that very clever. So how do we make good decisions? Now, in a young church, good decisions often come with a very small number of people. The pastor, basically, makes all these decisions. The good decision, it works. But as you get bigger, you have to share decisions. How does it happen? Now, he has some good insights. Let me just draw you a little diagram. What he talks about, he has this grid, and he talks about decision, and he has plus, minus, and then here, we'll call it do, implementation, decisioning and implementing, decisioning and doing. Now, in a small church, decisions are fast and implements fast. It's a sunny day. We'll have a picnic very fast. Most decisions in fun. This is the fun. This is when you're in a start. My son is running a physio business. He's gone. He's just hit Whitewater, I've told him. He's gone from two employees, him and his business partner. They're now employing 40 employees. It's gone from two to 40 in about 4 years. Okay, he's gone from scary, no customers, is it going to survive, to whitewater chaos. But there was a time when they could make, we'll hire you now. Like fun. Decisions fast, implement fast. In treadmill, that sort of dull routine, decisions are often fast, but implementation is often slow. We get, in whitewater, you get treadmills over here. This is whitewater. Treadmill is decisions slow, implement. So whitewater is decisions fast, but implementation slow, because you haven't got the structure to make it happen. You know, we are going to get a new Bible version, and 6 months later they still haven't arrived. Well, who was going to do that? I don't know. I forgot. Then we did discuss it at an elders meeting. I thought you were going to do it. Did I say that I was going to? I didn't say I was going to do it. Well, I sent the minutes out. I put your name on it. Well, I didn't read those minutes. But I put it in underline, bold, italics. I don't read minutes when you send them to me, Ray. That's classic elders, isn't it? So decision was fast, but implementation was slow. In treadmill, its decisions are slow. So what he says is, in a healthy organisation, the decisions are slow, healthy, but the implementation is fast. So you think hard and long about going to two morning meetings. You think hard and long about it. You think of all the different alternatives. You look at, you get people on board. You start thinking, could we do this? How many people do we need? What would be the best times? How are we going to find that out? Is this theologically correct or not? Is this a risk too far? Do we need to do it? Is the building 80% full? Have we plateau? You decide. You discuss that for ages till you're really clear. This is the only option. We're constrained. We can't do a new build. We can't plant just at the moment. We're going to have to do this, but we need to think. But then implementation needs to be fast. It's no good saying, we might go to two morning meetings in 3 or 4 years' time. We're going to just talk a lot. People go, oh, gee, I give up. This church can't organize itself out of a paper bag. Come on. So he's saying, look, now that's a simple, how do you make high quality team-based decision? You start working in the, let's, healthy churches decide slow. Let's really think about it. Discover. That's why you'll need all the voices on the table. We need a guardian voice to say, this is going to cost us too much, this option that you've put out. Or it might be, yeah, we can do it. But then you implement fast. And how do you implement fast? Well, he argues, I've come across this book recently, a guy called Scott Belsky. It's not about ideas, it's about making ideas happen. We tend to think that we're not very innovative Christians, we're a bit sort of same-ish. In fact, one of my friends, he said, where are you going this weekend? I said, oh, I'm going to the FIC Leaders Conference. He said, oh, 1,000 conservatives in the room at the same time. I said, oh, that's a bit harsh. I said, no, they're not all my age. He said, okay, there are 1,000 young conservatives all wearing beige jumpers. I said, oh, come on. But you see, his mindset was one of, you guys talk all the time, but you don't do. And Scott Belsky's saying, no, actually, the problem is not that there are ideas, is that we don't know how to do. We don't actually get ideas to happen. And what he argues, and I found this extremely helpful, he talks about the issue of action points. He says, now, how do you do action points in your church? Now, if he'd asked me when I was about 35, after being in ministry 10 years, I'd have coughed and spluttered and I would have said, we don't have action points on our agendas. One of our deacons told me that. So we put action points on our agendas. I thought, right, we've got action points. But what Scott Belsky put is, he sort of trod on my bunion toe, as it were, and said, how do your action points work? And I thought, well, basically I write the minutes and I do what I just described to you. I send the minutes round, and like in the meeting where somebody said, oh, leave that with me, I put, Peter will said leave it with me, and you know, sort of like bold. And when I'm on a really good week, I will print it out and get a yellow underliner and put it under and then give it to Peter and say, Pete, there, read that. Nothing happens. Nothing happens. Well, you know why? Because you don't read minutes. Even when it's got your name all over it. And I say, read the minutes. They're really important because you've all agreed on action points. I don't read those minutes ever again. Why do I think they're going to read the minutes ever again? Then I wonder, what, you know, you've been at meetings like, so you know that, we don't use this phrase, but a lot of matters arising, or some technical phrase like, it's the same old stuff. And eventually everybody's bored. Oh, let's just... You know what it is on your in-tray. Leave it there long enough, it'll be out of date. And that's true in church. Like, leave it there long enough, it'll just disappear. So what Scott Belsky said, right, this is a one way around this organisational mess where everybody's kind of like sort of trundling through thick mud. Get everybody in the room to personally verbalise their own action point. You never, he said, look, if you've got a meeting and there are no action points, question, should we have a meeting at all? He said, every item on every agenda needs action points. And at the end of the meeting, don't, as a leader, summarise the action points, go around the room and let everybody say what they think their action point is. And then they self-correct. Oh, I'm going to do this by then. And Joe says, no, you're also going to do that by then as well. Oh, did I say it? Yes, you did. Yeah, all right, so I'm going to do duh, 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 duh. And he said, now look, that is not going to make it happen miraculously, but you've given yourself a much greater chance. Because when people take a personal action point, and not having to worry about the whole, because that's what happens when you read the minutes, you read the whole thing and go, oh, crumbs, oh, never mind. Whereas when you get personal, right, I said I would do this by then. And we all say the same to each other, and by the next meeting, if somebody hasn't done what they said by then, you can say, come on, you said you'd do that by then. Yeah. You know, my bad, my fault. Or, yeah, I did. And I've it's just a tweak. It sounds crazy. Can church life really go forward with individuals owning action points? Sounds crazy. But, you know, like every big problem, break it down into little problems, and it's amazing what a difference it makes. I could see Richard at the back there. Richard and I did this at one of your meetings recently, didn't we? And you could see these elders, they're like, what? So every one of you, what's your action? And the action point may simply be, I'm going to write a 100-word summary of what I've learned today. That's an action point. Action points can be understanding. Like, I'm going to write down what I got out of this seminar today in 100 words. That's my action. It doesn't all have to be do, 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 but it has to be something that you are going to own. And if you don't own it, it won't happen. And if teams want things to happen, each team member needs to say, my action point from this meeting is. And you've all of a sudden start translating good ideas into making things happen. That's a little bit of wisdom insight from Les McEwen and Scott Belsky. So just some hints and tips. Soft skills, if you like, to create greater team understanding, clarity about roles, running good meetings, and a little bit about how we might make better decisions to make things happen. Now, we've got about 10 minutes. We didn't have a time yesterday. Comments, reflections, questions. Shout loud and we'll do our very best. Yes.
Thank you. So I've just started as a minister. What you said earlier in the main meeting about seeing yourself as pastor and teacher was really relevant to me, and I've discovered over the last few months that actually I really need to grow the kind of king leadership gifting, and I've been looking for training resources, and I've ended up mainly looking in the secular world because I've found that church training doesn't particularly do this, and I just wondered if there are any resources you can recommend, because the way you presented it from the Bible is this is something that isn't just, we're not just borrowing wisdom from the business world, we're applying biblical wisdom. I'd love to find resources like that. That would be far better. Are there things you can recommend?
Well, there is a lot out there, really. Some of the people writing in the business world are Christians. So Patrick Lencioni, he describes himself as an evangelical Catholic. He's a really God-fearing, godly man. I mean, as I said to you yesterday, he came out very boldly with, there is, you know, I don't like the phrase servant leadership. What? Because it implies there is another kind of leadership that's authentic. There is only servant leadership. So a lot of his books are not business books. They are thinly veiled Christian understanding of human beings in a different organizational context. Books like, there are some really good leadership books out there written by Christians. Australian guy wrote a big thick book. Brain gone dead. Wisdom in Leadership. A lot of Bill Hybels stuff. Now look, okay, stuff about Bill Hybels that I never agreed with in the first place, and stuff that's gone sadly wrong since. But there's still a ton of godly wisdom. So his book, Leadership Axioms, Courageous Leadership, there's some great stuff in his world.
Ready, Steady, Grow.
That's everybody else's good ideas regurgitated. That's all it is, yeah. But ping me an email and I can send you some references. At the top of my head, I would think what would be the best thing to read. So thanks for that, yeah.
How do you actually go about training a leader of a small team? Would you say you're trying to get them to adopt the sort of care plan? I mean, do you yourself, say, lead a meeting and get them to watch you and see what you did? Do you then sit on a meeting that they lead and comment? What sort of practically would you do to try and raise up that sort of leader?
Yeah, if you look how Jesus trained the 12, spending time with him, but then they watched him, then he watched them, then he sent them off and they came back and they debriefed. If you read, now we use that language and you might not read it in the Gospels, that's basically what he did. So he sends out the 12, they all come back, rejoicing. And well, don't rejoice because the demons obey you, rejoice because your name is written in the book of life. So Jesus is pointing out lessons all the time. They've just gone and done a field exercise, as it were. They've just gone and done some practice. They come back. And there are times they come across problems, your disciples could not cast, if you look at how Jesus does it all the time, he uses that basic training methodology which says, I do it, you watch me. You do it, I watch you. You do it when I'm not watching you. Then I watch you train somebody else to do it. Because only when you've trained somebody else do I really know that you've got it. That's how midwives are trained. I watch you, you watch me, I watch you. You then do it without me, and then I watch you do it with somebody else. Then when they know that that third person's got it, you've trained. So there's all kinds of ways of training. Now here's the thing, you see. You'll say, I haven't got the time to do that. Because what happens is straws get laid on camel's back, don't they, in pastoral life. It's one another and another and another. And you think, I cannot. You've got to build this in. It's one of the big rocks. Paul says to Timothy, the things you've heard from me, pass on to others. You have to say, part of my job is to train leaders all the way through the church. I didn't know that. I thought I got to train other pastor teachers, and the church would look after itself if we had enough pastor teachers. But I've learned since, I need to train small group leaders. I need to train task team leaders. I need to invest in that. Now, they're volunteers, so they don't have as much time. I can't say, we're going to meet every evening for the next month. Once a week for the next month. They haven't got one of those. So we get our team leaders together maybe once or twice a year, and then one of our staff workers spends a lot of his time working with task team leaders, just as one of our staff workers spends a lot of his time with small group leaders. Now, we're a church of a certain size, but when we were earlier, I apportioned my time a bit like that. I spent about a third of my time on the frontline evangelism, a third of my time teaching and maturing the church and establishing home groups, and a third of my time getting all the teams behind the scenes working. But as they grew, we said, right, you as a staff worker, you take that zone. You as a staff worker take that zone, and this staff worker takes that zone. So, but you have to invest. D.L. Moody, I'd rather train 10 men than do the work of 10 men. Well, once you get that, you go, okay, are you going to train? How are you going to do it? And some of these things, they just take time. But once you've got some good team leaders, it becomes, learn by osmosis. A good team leader, one of the tasks of a good team leader is who is going to take this job on from you. You're always looking for your replacement. So you're already getting your team leads to invest in the next team leader. And once that begins to happen, it kind of works easier than you think it does. But it's challenging. We want everybody to be correct on every doctrine. We don't run risks very well. We want everybody to be absolutely on the button just in case they do something stupid. But you don't have many people who are not stupid in your church, do you? We all are, aren't we? We've all got sinful, stupid things in our lives. So somehow you've got to, with all their flaws, we've got to help people go forward with this. And then it's very exciting to see what God can do, because he takes the weak to do the great things. But it's a hard call of investment in leadership time, but it's absolutely essential. Yeah. How are we doing for time? 1 minute. One more, anyone? Yeah.
How do you develop the patience not to meddle with the teams?
Yes.
And on the flip side, how does the team know how to tell the pastor it's to stop meddling?
Yes. Okay, so John Maxwell wrote a very, very helpful book called 360 Degree Leader. And he talks about leading south, so that's how you lead the people who are following you. He talks about leading east-west, that's talking about peers. But most of his book is about how to lead north, how to lead up to your supervisor or your boss or your pastor. And he has some very, very brilliant insights. So we tend to think of leadership as the people who are following my team. But actually, if you're in a church, you also need to talk to other leaders. So if you're the vision team, you need to talk to the sound team guys. Or if you're, we have a creche for tots, you also need to talk to the people who run a thing for slightly older children. You need to talk peers sideways, eastward. But he said the biggest challenge is leading north, leading up. So things like always realize your boss's time is precious, so don't waste it. Don't lead up what should have been led down. Like the Xerox work. The Xerox machine is working, Ray. You are free in the daytime. Please, can you be in when the Xerox man comes to fit the Xerox machine? Well, for a busy pastor who's trying to repair a broken marriage and then take a funeral this afternoon, that's very, like, oh, like, okay, I'll do it. But you do too much of that. You lead up to your boss like that. He's going to, like, do his nut in. But you can then say, look, like, one of the brilliant things Maxwell says is go to your boss with the problem solved. We had this problem. Sue had a hissy fit at the last team meeting. But I've been round to see her. She's asked for forgiveness. It's all solved, Ray. And if you get to hear that Sue had a hissy fit, don't worry about it. It's solved. And I'm like, oh, great. Which basically says, keep out, Ray. Keep out. We're solving it. So if you go to the boss with a problem solved, you do that a few times, the boss goes, right, great. Leave it with you then. And if he's tends to be over-controlling, there are ways of speaking up to the boss, as it were, to say, look, you know, you're doing that smart thing where you're not smart, you're accidentally diminishing it, you're over-controlling, it's tending to leave us feel a little bit like, hold on, don't you trust us anymore? So you can do those kind of things. So he has some very, very wise insights. Again, John Maxwell, pastor of a church, wrote loads of books that are ostensibly for the business world, but they're not really. They're about how human beings work together. And that is a leading north, he calls it. He has loads to say about leading up. And that's where all team leaders need to how to be a 360-degree leader. How do I lead south, east, west, and up north? Time's gone. Shall I just pray? Heavenly Father, we've ranged through very many things in a long morning. Some of it won't be very helpful. Some of it won't be very wise either. So please help us to filter out all that. And Lord, if anything is going to be helpful, if anything is going to be for the future prosperity of the gospel and the health of our churches, may we hear with understanding, and may we be those who can help our churches go forward, especially in this whole area of team life and getting people to serve you well. Please help us to realize as a sacred trust to enable your children to serve you well. We commend ourselves to you now, and we thank you for each other, and thank you for your time. In Jesus' name, amen.